Today is Wednesday. It's August 31st, 2022, and it's 2:39 in the afternoon. Hi, this is John Williams, and thanks for finding the Mincing Rascals podcast. Portions of this are going to be broadcast Saturday night on WGN Radio. Get your friends to listen to the radio and get them to download the Mincing Rascals podcast. You can also hear me weekdays from 10 to 2 on WGN.
Hi, I'm John Hansen. I'm on WGN Radio, on WCIU-TV, and Block Club Chicago.
Hi, I'm Mark Garino, Chicago freelance for the Washington Post and producer with ABC News.
I'm Eric Zorn, the optimistic proprietor of the Picayune Sentinel weekly newsletter.
Well, that's promising. Last week you were weary. I can't believe I remember that. Why are you optimistic this week, Eric?
I'm optimistic because of what the Justice Department is saying about what they found at Mar-a-Lago, and it really looks like former President Trump is in some serious legal trouble. I know that's not on our list of topics today, but it really looks like this is going to be a particularly difficult situation for him to wriggle out of, that his lawyers and his people were telling the federal government that they had nothing there and they turned it all over. And it turned out that that was just a lie and provable in many different dimensions. And I love to see it.
Will eventually be adjudicated, but it sure looks like those boxes contain top secret documents, because we've seen now pictures of one of the boxes with top secret documents, and also a gold framed Time magazine cover that featured Donald Trump's detractors looking through a window in the cartoon in the cover of Time magazine. Honestly, Eric, I don't think they should have included that in the photograph, although I've read an analysis that says that that proves that this is in Donald Trump's personal effects. So it doesn't prove it, but it suggests that he knew those documents were there. He can't claim that he had no knowledge of them.
You know, as a marketing tool, that photo really works, because I think they realize they have to do some marketing, because this is so unprecedented that, you know, there are some lives at stake. You know, there's FBI agents, you know, all over the country who are now targets. And so you're seeing the Justice Department really get more aggressive in how it's presenting these legal documents. They're not putting out press releases, but within those legal documents, if you read them, they are more explicit than I think that they would be typically. And I think that photo was thrown in there as an image that news organizations can use to spread far and wide, you know, their case. And because I think they're backed in the corner, they kind of have to answer, because they know the Trump playbook. The Trump playbook is deny and attack. And so because I think that the Justice Department is so, you know, again, because there's lives at stake on their end, that they have to basically make a strong case, not just to the courts, but to the public.
Well, I think it's interesting that the only reason we're seeing any of this stuff is because this is based on the Trump team wanting a special master, right? And
yes, yeah.
You know, this is where we've seen a lot of the evidence come forward, is not obviously, as you were saying, through press releases or what Merrick Garland had to say. It's in response to things that either the Trump team wanted or the news organizations wanted when they wanted the affidavit unsealed. And I think the fascinating thing is just to look at what is said by the Trump team on news versus what Trump's lawyers are saying in court. And for example, not even posting an objection to releasing the affidavit, the Trump lawyers were, or not, you know, not for it, like President Trump had said. So it's interesting the way we're getting this information and how much the Justice Department is detailing. When they have that opportunity to put it out there, or at least to file this away, they're taking that opportunity to show that evidence.
I think there's two fronts going on. I mean, I think Trump is working a public relations war because he's still weighing whether he wants to be president, and he wants to see whether he still has influence over this party. And then there's the court battle going on, and sometimes they have different responses.
It strikes me as being snarky. The criminal offense will not be having a framed cover of Time magazine. It'll be having documents, classified or otherwise. But that they threw that in there, to me, was just a jab in the ribs, an ear flick, I think is how we described it on the radio. I understand the dots that they're trying to connect there, but it struck me as the sort of thing they knew would get a lot of clicks and a lot of chatter. If you're in a defensive position, maybe you play that game. That sort of thing is not important here.
I was saying, I just thought it was really interesting. Another thing that adds to my optimism is the fact that Ann Coulter has declared that the Trump era in the Republican Party is done. And she thinks that the party is going to be moving on from his reign, and that it's safe again to be a Republican who's against Trump. I'm not sure that that's true, but the fact that Ann Coulter is saying it means that there is some possibility that it will become true.
That I don't know. She's been off the Trump train for a while, though, Eric. Yeah. I think it'll be more meaningful when Ron DeSantis says that, or someone that's actually trying to beat him in 2024.
But she wrote the book. What was it, E Pluribus Trump? Was that the name of her book? I can't remember now. But or in Trump We Trust. I can't. But she was solidly behind him, and she is a fairly major commenter still.
Was my question, Eric. She's not a Fox News regular, is she? I don't know what platform she's on or how people are consuming her. I haven't heard from Ann lately.
I think she does her own, she has her own followers, and she writes books and she's guests on people like Bill Maher's show.
Add her to the Picayune Sentinel, Eric.
I'll give her own column if she keeps it up.
What about this, guys? Different subject now. The Downers Grove Public Library is going to host a bingo night for teens and tweens, 7th graders through 12th graders. The host will be a drag queen that goes by the name Aurora Divine. So here we go again. The mayor of Orland Park, Keith Peacock, is the Republican candidate for Congress in the 6th Congressional District. And while he has never been to a drag show or drag bingo, he says he knows what they are. They're inappropriate and tax dollars should not be so used. So now at an event that should be welcoming and inclusive, this bingo night for teenagers, police are going to provide security and it's almost certainly going to attract protesters. So I'm pushing back at the pushback. Out of the gate, I don't think that the library should have done this. Is this the business of a library? I believe in their intentions, however, and the BS being peddled around this has made me a supporter of the event. But what did the library think was going to happen?
I think there's a lot, right? And I have to admit my personal connection in that I grew up in Downers Grove and I'm moving back to Downers Grove in a month. And I grew up as a gay teenager, well in the closet. And so I admit my biases and I respect everyone's opinion. And look, I listened to your show today, John, and there was a lot of really good, like thoughtful opinions, people that have been to drag shows that were still against it. And I just want to get that out there, just that I do understand where people are. And there's a few things that we have to establish first and foremost. A drag queen is not necessarily someone who is transgender. Not all transgender people are drag queens. Not all drag queens are transgender. Those are two completely different things. Drag queens are performers. It's an art form. They cater their performance to the audience. It's similar to stand-up comedy. Of course, a stand-up comedian in front of a bunch of adults is going to be raucous. There may be sexual jokes in there. A drag queen in front of a bunch of adults will do the same thing. So the thought that that same performance that an adult would see at a bar where they ID you at 21 and older at a gay bar on the north side of Chicago, that would somehow be the show that's going to be presented at the Downers Grove Library to tweens is ridiculous. They're performers. They're artists. And this is part of the gay community. It's a huge part of the LGBTQ community. No, we don't all go to drag shows every night and every weekend, but it's a big part of our community. And I just got to say that if I had grown up in Downers Grove at an age when the Downers Grove Public Library said, we're going to have drag bingo, I wouldn't have even had to go to the show to know that that meant that my town, the town I live in, recognizes who I am and I'm not some social outcast. And that would have done a lot to not drive myself perhaps further into the closet. And I grew up in a very lucky situation. I know people that have committed or tried to kill themselves because of their identity, teens and tweens, because they don't feel accepted with where they live in their home or in the community they live in. And so I say, it's well worth the effort to do that. And it's well worth the trouble.
John, what you just described though, would be a feature, not a bug, of this thing for people who are who would want the library. If you're allowing the library to sort of express acceptance of gay teenagers and of different gender expressions and so on, that's not something that the people who are opposed to this consider to be an advantage. they consider that to be a disadvantage. They don't want that message going out. It's my take on this. They don't want the message right. going out.
They're also spreading conspiracy theories that there's grooming of young children. I think it's actually more insidious, the backlash. It's not that it's just it is anti-gay, but also they go, what I've read at least, that it seems like it's skipping five steps ahead, and they're talking about all this insidious stuff.
He used the word targeting on our show today, the mayor, the congressional candidate, targeting these kids.
Well, isn't all marketing targeted all the time?
I guess.
I get stuff targeted to me all the time because of my interests. And so that's just, again, an insidious word to scare people.
I've got to say, I don't think that this is the kind of thing that kids should be forced to go to. Or forced to witness. That the fact that it's at the library, it's a voluntary event, is a very different question than whether these things should be taking place, say, in public schools. I don't know if John Hansen agrees with that or not, but that
I do. I think it's up for parents to decide with their kids. But it also, anytime I hear a parent say, "Well, how do I explain this to kids?" I mean, don't you have to explain everything to kids? I mean, I'm not a parent, but is it that hard to say that sometimes entertainers dress as the other gender for a performance? Like, what is so hard about saying that?
Well, and also, if these same parents, I'm assuming they all have televisions, and I'm assuming they all have at some point exposed their kids to things like the RuPaul show. I'm assuming they've seen, you know, the Rolling Stones in the early 70s, footage of that, you know, Mick Jagger's wearing a lot of makeup. I mean, this is kind of like the idea that all these images are completely new. This is all very mainstream. It's not just on the north side of Chicago. Gender bending has been around for a long time. I know that's not exactly what this is, but it's this idea of like clutching their pearls, that this is going to destroy the fabric of the family home in Downers Grove is a bit absurd in 2022.
Well, the criticism of that was that, fine, but let's just not confuse kids. Let's not promote by including some of these less than mainstream lifestyle choices when kids are vulnerable. This is the sort of rhetoric I heard on the radio today.
I think there's a separate issue going on besides the one we're talking about, is what is the role of the public library in these communities? And libraries definitely have gotten, if you notice, if you drive through the suburbs of Chicago over the last 10 years, you're seeing that basically a lot of money, a lot of these library systems have gotten a lot of grant money to rebuild big. The library's now very big. They're very modern. They have a lot of facilities. And now they're serving a little bit more than just the traditional roles of the library. They're community centers, and they have programs that have nothing to do with books or, you know, the traditional role of the library. And I think if that's – I think that that might be more – possibly more of a legitimate question – whether that's appropriate or not, whether a library should be doing all this like incredible programming, and they have these giant staffs, and is that serving the original mission of a library or not? I'm not saying I have a stance on that or not, but I think that is sort of, I think, clouding a lot of what's going on here.
And I think a lot of things going on with the libraries have to do with the availability of media. It's online, that you're not going to be going to the library probably to look up magazine articles. Many people have books on their devices that they carry around, that they're not being used for sort of the traditional library type features, but they're used for you can get streaming video, you can get ebooks, you can get, it's a sort of resource center for all kinds of information that you would otherwise have to buy.
You know, a lot of libraries now have, you can go there and play video games. I think that issue is a little separate. I think some of this is kind of because of, well, of that, you know, some of the people being very upset, like, why is the library doing a drag queen bingo night?
I agree with you in principle with that idea, but we all know that if it was a guy with a guitar doing bingo night, this would never have made the news, right? So, like, obviously that is the reason why we're talking about this. But your point is valid, right? Like, what role is a library? Are our tax dollars paying for? Like, I've seen laser light shows at libraries advertised. So, yeah, there is a broader conversation here. But let's not mistake, and I'm not suggesting that you are, the reason why we're talking about this. It's, I don't know, like, we all have taxpayer dollars that we spend that go to things that we don't like. it's like part of what this is. This American existence, right? Like that's what it is. And I don't know what people are so afraid of. And I admit this is part because I'm part of a world where I've been to drag shows and, you know, and maybe it kind of made even my eyes open up wide the first time. And I thought, what the heck's going on here? And I said that as a gay adult. So I understand why people have a little apprehension about what it is, but I think they've been fed lies about what they are.
This is not a show like you would have seen at the Baton. Right. I mean, this is not, I presume it's not going to be a particularly or even slightly sexualized show that it's just campy. Right. I mean, that's what you'd expect.
Camp humor is everywhere today. I mean, camp humor is that's like, you know, you can't escape. I mean, that's just a mainstream America camp humor.
But you can understand why people would blush or pause when they said, guess what they're doing at the Downers Grove Public Library? They're having a drag queen host bingo for seventh graders. That's an unforced error, if you ask me.
And that's my point, is that these public library systems now have so much money that they're expanding beyond what their traditional mission is. They're setting themselves up for, you know, they're going to make tons of mistakes, or they're going to not hit the wrong tone. And like, why are libraries now suddenly programmers? And this is just like, yeah, if it was a guy with a guitar, no, we won't care. But I think that calling it drag queen bingo night, it's like serving red meat up for national attention.
Well, what did they think? What did they think was going to happen? I mean, we just had this thing at the bakery where...
But they thought that people in their community who identify as LGBTQ+ would feel that they were in a welcome town that was okay with it. Like, it wasn't even a big deal. Of course, it's now becoming an even bigger deal. I know they knew what they were getting into, but sometimes that's an important stance to take, even if it ruffles some feathers, John.
Yeah, that's I like that point, John. I appreciate that. Here's a quote from the library director. We understand this topic will be controversial to some. However, we must recognize that not including them also causes harm. We want everyone in our community to see the library and know they are represented in cared for here. So this is a way for the library to be proactive and inclusive. You know, maybe the whiplash I'm expressing here, my description of it as an unforced error, is just proof that the tide is changing a little bit, that this is the world that we are living in that is evolving for the better, perhaps, right? But that you can understand why people would have a reaction to it.
Yes.
At least a reaction to it.
The nature of the suburbs has completely changed from when we were younger, obviously. And it's gone along with society. And so the idea that this is groundbreaking or something actually is sort of weird, because, you know, the suburbs are very diverse in many ways. I don't know Downers Grove, but I'm assuming it's not the Downers Grove of the 1970s.
Well, this is maybe evidence of that. I just want to read you guys one other quote from the director of the library. Based on research we have available to us, children are aware of gender as a concept by the age of 2, and by age 3 are beginning to understand and form their own identity. Teens grades 7 through 12 have established their own sense of self, or are exploring what their sense of self is through providing opportunities for teens to see their own identities and identities of others. The library is providing opportunities for teens to recognize that difference is okay and celebrated, and to see it by example. You know, what I don't understand is, I think that's a great point and a good idea, too. I think that we should teach kids at the earliest age to be as accepting of people who dye their hair purple or are gay or identify not in the traditional means that we've asked people to identify. So maybe it's not even so much an LGBTQ acceptance issue as it is for all of us to just recognize that it's a colorful world out there.
Right.
Maybe
right.
That's where this thing lands.
Right. And I think that's a great point, right? I think that the drag community obviously very intertwined with the LGBTQ community. So I think it's an obvious head nod to the community. But you're right. It's a performer. It's an art piece. It's an art form. And, you know, not to get too personal, but I mean, I grew up in Downers Grove. I knew I was gay when I was 10 years old, and there was no drag bingo in Downers. So it's not going to make anybody gay. Trust me.
Can I just want to amplify what you were just saying about the symbolism behind this and why it is important. And that is that when the library is sending out this message. That is what people are upset about. They're not upset about their children. They don't have to send their children to this show. Children who go to this show are going to be going willingly. Their parents are going to probably approve. They're probably going to drive them there if they're seventh graders. And they're going to be receiving this message that it's okay to tolerate people of different gender expressions. That's what this protest is about, is they don't want the library to make that statement. That's what this is about, because if people were being forced to go to this, if this was an unwilling audience, there'll be a whole different question. But this is a voluntary event in a community building. And I think you're right, John, that it was putting a controversial issue right down in front of everybody. But that's what the controversy is about. Let's be clear about that.
Mm. Okay.
Thank you all for letting me hop in on that.
Yeah. Thanks. Hey, moving day in a month, huh?
Yeah. Yeah. Less than that. So.
All right. Well, we'll look for our invitation to the housewarming.
Just in time for bingo. So.
I think we get an invitation to his housewarming if we help move his sofa. That's the way that works, Eric. So maybe.
No, don't worry. I would love to have. We're right by the Tivoli, so I'd love to have a minting get together. So,
Good to know. Good. You're going to be living near the Tivoli Theater in Downers Grove.
Yeah, I'm like I don't know, 4 minute drive from the Tivoli.
I will get you tickets to our Teddy Roosevelt show, sir.
I appreciate it. All right.
See you, John.
Take care. Thanks, guys.
John Hansen tapping out. By the way, by reference to that, I'm not sure when you are going to hear this, but as of today, the last day of August, there's a few hundred seats left in about a 900-seat auditorium, the Tivoli Theater in Downers Grove, for our Teddy Roosevelt show. Clay Jenkinson is a guy who acts as Roosevelt and Jefferson on stage. It's a one-person show. He's going to do this time Teddy Roosevelt, but I'll interview him on stage and then the audience asks questions. And it's been selling like hotcakes. We've moved about, I don't know, over 600 tickets in a few days here, $33 a ticket. But you really do get a sense of what a president could be like. This is a guy who comes on in costume as Teddy Roosevelt, and very quickly you believe that that's Teddy Roosevelt. The show is very funny, but it's also very true. You know, he talks about charging up San Juan Hill. He talks about losing his son in battle in World War I and crying. We get emotional at times hearing these tales, but, you know, it's the truth of Teddy Roosevelt. And then you say, okay, how would that play today? And it's fascinating. It's very fun. Eric saw Jefferson show.
I'd like to second that, John. I saw the Jefferson show a year ago that the same the presenter did, and it was terrific. It was like a play. And you were great too, John. I mean, really, you performed a wonderful interview with the guy. But it was funny. It was interesting. It was well worth the drive to Downers Grove.
He doesn't know the questions I'm going to ask, and we sure don't know what the audience is going to ask. So it's certainly got a very spontaneous feel about it. Somebody asked me today, in fact, on the radio, I wonder what Roosevelt would say about that bingo night in Downers Grove. And who knows, maybe we'll ask him. He was a cowboy, but he was also very progressive on issues. And I know we're going to ask him about this. Darren Bailey says that the University of Illinois at Urbana students should be from the state of Illinois. 90%, he said, of the freshman class by 2026, he's going to graduate it in from the about 75% they're at now. But he says 90% of the freshman class by 2026 would have to be residents of the state of Illinois. I think this would sell. The U of I says that no student who gets accepted, we asked them about this and they sent out a statement. They didn't come on the radio, but they said that the University of Illinois says that no student who gets accepted with a family income of under $67,000 has to pay. I didn't realize that. Still, the school says the biggest challenge they have, and including in-state residents, is that many say they can't afford it. The kids who pay from out of state and out of country pay two and three times what in-state residents pay. Kids from China pay closer to $50,000 in tuition and books. One last thing. They also say they are trying to create a diverse community, and that 90% of the kids being from in-state would not be that. still, I think what Darren Bailey says will play.
And I think that's why he said it. It sounds good. It sounds like one, it sounds in a way kind of if he was running for president, it sounds kind of a nationalist sort of thing. He wants everyone to stay and support the University of Illinois. But I think like with a lot of things with Darren Bailey, they're not necessarily thought through very well. If that were actually to happen, University of Illinois' budget would be falling because they get a ton of money from out-of-state students and from foreign exchange students. I know it, someone who teaches ESL at the University of Illinois, but in Chicago, he has informed me of sort of the sizable population from outside the U.S.
So I have no doubt that they would have to hike in-state tuition significantly if they were to take, what, 15% of the population that is now paying full freight, and then offering them, trying to offer them in-state tuition, that the schools have budgets they have to meet. And this idea, I mean, it's not inherently a terrible idea, and I don't really buy the diversity argument. You could still have 10% of your student body coming from overseas and other states, and you would still have a fairly diverse environment, especially if you wanted to prioritize diversity in admissions from within Illinois. Illinois is a big, long state with lots of different ethnicities, a lot of different income levels. You could have a very, very diverse student body at U of I, but if you're giving free tuition to families that make under $67,000, was that what you said?
Yeah.
If you're giving free tuition to those families, you're going to have the people who are sort of in that middle income area are going to be asked to pay a significantly more amount of money if you're going to continue to have the services and have the quality of the institution that you want to have. So I think it may play well politically, but if people think it through, like our friend Mark Guarino just did, they're going to say, like, no, maybe not. Not such a great idea.
No, then maybe they're not going to think it through, because I know a lot of families in the suburbs of Chicago, and this resonates there, whose kids worked hard at good schools, and they got B pluses, and they got a decent score on their ACT, and they didn't get into the U of I. And that's this marquee public university. I know we got the U of C and Northwestern, but those are private schools, and they're crazy expensive and selective. You'd like to think that the University of Illinois would be there for all of the kids in Downers Grove, and yet a lot of them don't get in, but a kid from Kansas would, or a kid from China would, with a similar resume. It breaks their hearts, some of them, that now they're going to go to Indiana. I don't know what their fallback schools are, Illinois State, wherever. They want to go to the U of I. They have the feeling they've helped pay for it, even though not that much state revenue goes to the University of Illinois now. But I understand why this would be a very popular thing for him to say.
So if you have been dreaming all your life to go to the Big Ten school within Illinois, you got to get better grades to get in here, you know, better scores to get in there. I couldn't have gone into Illinois. I was as a high school student, so I didn't even apply because I didn't have great grades in high school. And so I just went somewhere else. It's in a way what Eric had mentioned. It's actually, if his plan, let's say, magically gets into place, it's actually going to hurt students in Illinois and hurt families in Illinois because the tuition's going to go up.
The University of Texas at Austin, they do this. North Carolina does this. University of North Carolina. I'm trying to remember which campus, Chapel Hill.
Is it 90%, you're saying? 90%?
One of them has like an 82-18 number. One of them has a 90-10 number. But we would not be the only school or state in the union that's doing something to protect in-state students to go to the school. I think the average GPA, I think the prestige of the school would go down. I don't know if that matters to anybody.
I think it matters to the people who are applying to that school. I mean, why would you apply to the U of I if it has the same standards as Western Illinois University? You know, I mean, there's a reason why U of I is U of I. It is because of the prestige and the research and the money that's there.
And is that why we don't have a reciprocal agreement with other states? Because there are some states in the region that, I think you said, like Minnesota, Wisconsin, you can cross the state border and still get in-state tuition. Illinois does not have that.
We do not, and we don't need it because everybody wants to go to the University of Illinois. I don't know what they have at Michigan, your alma mater, Eric, but it seems to me like they could pick and choose all they want. And so if you are an Illinois student and you get accepted at Minnesota, you're going to pay out-of-state tuition. But a Wisconsin kid, this is my understanding, forgive me if I have the states wrong, going to Minnesota would pay in-state tuition because Minnesota and Wisconsin are going to treat each other like in-state kids at those Big Ten schools. But Illinoisans don't get that break because we get to be so damn selective here. And you do know there's a lot of foreign and out-of-state kids at the U of I. They say that they like the diversity that they're getting. That was their statement to us.
I would be very interested in finding out what the research shows about what happened at these universities when they implemented their 82-18 or 90-10 programs, what the difference was in tuition, what the difference was in the standing of the school, because the reputation of the school is very important. I think both University of Texas and University of North Carolina are well regarded, but I don't know if their stature slipped when they did that. I don't know. I have no way of knowing, but that would be an interesting thing to throw into the conversation for
well,
sure.
Well, you're an independent journalist now, Eric. Why don't you look into that and report back to us next week?
I will. I'll go to my local library.
You know, with all of this in mind, we do know more now about student loan forgiveness. This is what I've discovered in the last week. Parent PLUS loans are included. Loans disbursed by June 30th of this year are eligible. So if you got a loan July 1st, you would not be eligible. The cutoff date is June 30th. The government is going to set up some sort of website. It's not there yet where you can register. I'm anxious for that to open up and crash. You will not pay federal income taxes on the amount you receive in forgiveness, but in at least 13 states, you may owe state income taxes on the amount that you get in forgiveness. So if it's $10,000, Illinois might include that as $10,000 of income, and then you'd have to pay a couple grand in state income taxes or whatever it is. I don't know that Illinois is one of those states that would tax it. Just one more week into digesting the fallout from that.
I think when we spoke about this last week, I was a little bit hesitant about the income thresholds. And I think that I was expressing some support for, say, limiting the interest rates that can be charged.
Yeah.
That you want to make sure that you don't just keep putting people into a deeper and deeper hole. And you want to make sure that the relief is going to people who really need it. And it seems like this has not been exactly well calibrated finally enough to do this. Like, I would rather them give more money to people who are earning less than to have, your household can make up to $250,000 and you can get this relief, I think, for all your children if you took out loans, which I can understand why some people would consider that to be unfair. On the other hand, we have a long tradition in our country of reaching a hand down and helping people out who have fallen or who are in financial distress or in other distress, especially for unforeseen reasons. So I think I like the concept and I'm a little dubious about the execution. At the same time, I don't think it's going to be a really major factor in how people vote. I don't think you're going to have people who are inclined to vote Democratic saying, I just can't forgive. I can't forgive the Democrats for forgiving $10,000 in student loans to people. I don't think that's going to happen.
I agree with everything you said, but I also think that it will be political for people. I think that Biden scored a lot of points for this. So I think people, who may, especially young people who are apathetic about Biden, are looking at, his point, his ratings are going up. The one thing, I worked on a story two stories for the Washington Post on this. And so I talked with a lot of people who are they considered it a game changer for them. And I really, it gave me a really deeper look into the situation for many young people who are struggling with debt. They're happy for people who are going to benefit from this. And so they feel strange being critical of it. But the same people who are providing loan forgiveness now are the same people who ignored this or even helped banks, 10, 20, 30 years ago. And so it's a little too little too late.
Well, this idea, and this came up in the podcast last week and on the radio, where some people say, when I was signing, I didn't realize what I was signing, what I was getting myself into. I struggle with that a little bit. I mean, I see how 18-year-olds are vulnerable and parents want anything for their kids, so they get themselves into this debt. But it's a pretty fundamental thing. You borrow money, you have to pay money back. You borrow $20,000, you have to pay back $25,000 or $30,000 with interest. That's not a real complicated concept. And I think people are very good at just sort of ignoring painful realities. They choose to. And then they say, I didn't appreciate the significance of this. A child appreciates if you take something, you have to give it back. So while I'm I'm happy to have this happen for people because I'm just a very generous guy, especially with other people's money, especially when it's not going to impact my life. So I'm happy to do this, but I don't know that I entirely accept that notion that people didn't appreciate what they were getting themselves into. I saw stories today, too, though, listeners to this radio station who are still texting in about having borrowed $30,000 and paid $30,000 back, plus another $30,000 in interest, and I still owe $30,000. That's screwed up. I mean, that's an institutional problem that maybe we could not have anticipated down the road. But
well, I mean, I think that side issue is like meet the need for media literacy. There needs to be financial literacy.
I guess
there. Those two things I think are really needed, especially at a young age.
But it's look, if I give you a candy bar, are you supposed to give me a dollar or whatever the candy bar costs? If I give you something, then you have to give me money in return, right? And if you don't have the money for the candy bar, but I give you the candy bar, you're at some point going to have to give me some money for the candy bar, maybe even a little more than the dollar that I was going to charge you up front. A child would understand that.
I think I see that point for sure. But I think that, like, you know, I talked to this one young woman who graduated from Marquette and she grew up in Waukesha. She was the first person in her family to go to college. And she told me that, like, going to college, she would do anything she could to get into college, that this was a really big deal, not just for her, but her family. And I think there's a lot of people out there who are they're willing to, like, sign the letter to, like, make this work because this was sort of a fundamental step for their future. Sometimes desperate people do desperate things in situations, and they sign things that they figured out it'll sort itself out later, and they're kind of caught holding the bag. I think that what I would love to see is some discussion about college tuition and why it's so expensive.
Yeah, I think it's important to talk about the cost of the bureaucratic layers in a lot of colleges. There's a lot of extra administrators in just about every institution like that have been added on over the years for various reasons, and they need to think about that carefully. When you are giving this sort of loan forgiveness, you are running the risk that colleges will bake that into their equation when they're setting tuition rates. I think it's also important, though, to say that $10,000 is not all of everyone. You're not forgiving everybody's loan and the entirety of the loan. I mean, when John talks about a candy bar, maybe you're talking about, you know, one square of one little part of the Twix bar instead of the whole thing. So we're not just, like, wiping it all clean. There are people who wanted that to be done, like all of it to be just erased. This is, like I say, it's a hand up. It's going to help people who are struggling. It's going to help the economy, probably. It's going to allow people to buy cars, to buy homes, to send their own kids to college. I mean, it's not like this is money just being shoveled down the sewer. This is something that's important. I do, however, also understand the blue collar worker who says, like, hey, I borrowed $10,000 to buy my truck so that I could have my plumbing business. Where's my loan forgiveness? I understand that. Or someone who says, like, hey, I had to borrow $10,000 to pay my medical bills, and that was totally unforeseen. That wasn't something I planned for. Where's my loan forgiveness? And again, I understand that too. I understand why people are feeling that way. But also, you have to keep in mind, as Mark points out, that we bailed out banks and financial institutions with billions of dollars. And I didn't hear people complaining
more than once.
But the people who are complaining now weren't complaining then, as far as I remember.
You know, that's another thing that's come up in this week, is that all the instances where we have all paid for somebody else's misdeeds, bankruptcies for billionaires, or payroll protection plan loans that did not have to be paid back. Of course, they were designed to not be paid back, but still, plenty of people got a lot of free money that all of us are now paying for. There's a whole host of examples historically where people were paying for something they did not or could not avail themselves of. And a sort of tangential example of that is Black Americans who for years pay taxes to support pools they couldn't swim in and libraries they couldn't go to and buses they had to sit in the back of. So this is not an unprecedented hand up, as you say, Eric. I see all of that. That's why ultimately I land on, let's go ahead and do that for these people, for all of us. But we do seem to sort of have a fundamental shift in this country these days, getting away from responsibility for your own actions, that if you do something, sometimes there are consequences. It's just so unfortunate that it's a consequence that follows you for the rest of your earning life.
I think it's only going to be successful if those conversations follow this.
I want to bounce one other thing off you guys before we wrap up this edition of The Mincing Rascals, and that's something that's been very hot in the newspapers and on radio this week, and that is the drifting, the business of doing spin-outs for a crowd in the streets of Chicago. Last weekend was a banner weekend for that, and it doesn't look like it's going to go away, and the city is seemingly unable to do anything about it. Eric, I know you had thoughts about that in your Picayune Sentinel. What are you thinking?
Well, it's not a particularly serious crime as compared to murders and shootings and sexual assaults and even and burglaries and robberies and so on. But it is one of those kind of corrosive, chaotic things that drag down the civic life. I mean, these guys are drifting to basically give the finger to the cops and to people who live in those areas who value their peace and quiet. You could open up a parking lot at Soldier Field and say, hey, go ahead and drift out there. They wouldn't want to do that. You could set up bleachers for them. That's not the point of this. The point of this is exactly the response that I'm sure your listeners have given and that some of my readers have given to me too, which is like, this is outrageous and the police need to get a hold on it. And it symbolizes an inability that the police have to get a hold of all kinds of other crimes like catalytic converter thefts, carjackings, and other things. So that I think it is important, even though it's on a scale of things, it's not a huge crime. I think it's important for the symbolism, if nothing else, for the city to get control of it. And I've noticed that the police have come out in the last few days and said they are really planning to crack down and have strike forces and task forces and make sure this doesn't continue.
And just talking about it doesn't do it justice without the video, but if you've seen the videos, it really is lawless looking, isn't it? I mean, where are the police? How are they getting away with this, you might ask yourself, when a busy intersection, even though it might be off hours, the one in front of our radio station still has black skid marks where people were doing these donuts in front of our radio station on Wacker Drive. And when you see it, it really looks remarkable. And then when the police have arrived of late, 12 squad cars were damaged last weekend in Chicago. 12 Chicago Police Department vehicles were damaged because the crowd then turns on the cops. I completely agree with you, Eric. If you said prioritize the problems in Chicago, this would be way down. Nobody's really injured in these things, except for some kids that get in the way of the cars, and I don't feel bad for them. But it looks so bad.
I think that actually it is a major public safety issue. You know, people have the right to drive through the streets of Chicago and not encounter this. You know, safety vehicles need to be able to get through intersections. I think it's a really it is a public safety thing. And it does remind me, I mean, I think it's obvious that what you were describing with the 12 police cars being damaged and they can't control it, as an example, the police standing down, at least to this point. It reminds me of two summers ago, you know, going downtown at 2 a.m. when there was mass looting going down North Michigan Avenue. There was a massive police presence at the same time. The police were lined up and down Michigan Avenue at the same time, while you could turn your head and see people looting in stores, and the police were doing nothing because they're just, you can't control a mob like that without getting your hands dirty a little bit, bringing in water cannons and all sorts of things we don't want to have images of. And so the police told me they were there to make sure the buildings don't catch on fire. That was their priority, not to stop the looting. And I think this is in that bucket of the police just, you know, to stop a massive group of people, it's going to turn into a riot and it's all going to be on a video. Yeah. And that's what the Chicago Police Department doesn't want to have, because they're going to, you know, there's only one party here who's going to look really bad out of that. And it's not the looters or not the drifters. If you ever told me that people would be looting in, you know, downtown Chicago, I never would have believed you. But now, of course, I'll believe you. And I think it's just sort of like it's a continual thing that the police seems powerless to handle. And so now it's just mounting.
It is the symbolism of it very much. Yeah. I don't think anyone's been hurt yet. And I don't know how that's happened, because you see these cars are spinning through these intersections. They're doing these sort of controlled skids and spins. And they're coming very close to spectators. And sooner or later, someone's going to get hit. Someone's going to be killed. And Mark's correct that if you were to try some sort of a great surge of police through one of these things, you would end up with a lot of violence and a lot of injuries. Probably they arrested 9 people and seized 7 vehicles. My guess is the answer is going to be figuring out a way to maybe use the salt trucks and things like that to block off certain intersections and then impound the vehicles within them once the people are cleared out.
Yeah.
But they can't let it keep going. And of course it'll end for the winter, right? But it may come back next summer bigger than ever. And if they don't figure it out, that's the kind of thing that does at some point get people to say, like, I don't want to live in the city anymore.
That's
a problem. And that is a problem when you can't control. And I lumped in the catalytic converter thefts and the carjackings. These things are happening, and these street robberies, they're happening in neighborhoods where they didn't used to happen so much anymore. I know maybe that sounds elitist or privileged or something like that, but those have political ramifications, and they have ramifications for people who are deciding where to live, where to move. And so it is extremely important for the police and the mayor to get control of things like this.
Yeah. I mean, the image is what sells cities. They send strong signals to people outside the city. And I'm just would love to see a prioritization of all that. And it's just sort of the city doesn't seem to know what it wants to do. You were talking to someone who had their catalytic converter stolen a couple of weeks ago. And let me tell you, you don't want that to happen to you. And it was on a street that I parked in on for 4 or 5 years. But it's been happening all throughout my neighborhood. I had my neighbor, one of my neighbors had a gun pulled on them while her husband caught somebody stealing the converter out of their car. So it's stuff that, again, the word is unprecedented. And I think this is stuff that it's not the long-term viability of the city really kind of hinges on it.
There's a video that I'm going to post in tomorrow's Picayune Sentinel from the CWB Chicago blog. And it's a doorbell camera video, and it shows a car pulling up and these guys getting out. Two of them are clearly carrying guns, and the third guy slips under the car and saws off the catalytic converter. From the time they get out of the car to the time they're back into the car is 40 seconds. And so the idea that you're going to have police out there stopping people as they're doing this is absurd. They're way too quick for that.
That's absurd. But what the police can do, what does not seem absurd, is that these are being sold somewhere. And I think that it's like chop shops. You can't tell me that it's not, there can't be a strategy to go find out where they're being sold. There's obviously a black market going on.
Where's the reporting been on that?
There's a front page story in the Tribune today about it.
About where they're being sold?
No, but it's about the entire problem and the scope of it.
Well, they want to paint them pink. Wasn't that part of the ideas that if you put a stamp on them and painted them pink, they'd be less attractive to the people that are buying them? Clearly, this is stolen merchandise.
They're buying them to cut them apart and take out the precious metals that are in them. They're not
people
buying them.
People buying them know that they're stolen. It's not that you're going to Target and trying to return it again.
Mark, what neighborhood was your catalytic converter stolen from?
In Lincoln Square. And the police told my neighbor that there's a gang going around and targeting, I own a Prius, and they were targeting Toyota Priuses.
Yeah, that's been a popular one.
And when I went to, the dealer told me it'd be 6 months before they could get a Toyota part to do it. And so I had to take it to another mechanic and get an aftermarket put in there. I had to go to Amazon and buy a shield. And now I'm actually getting a garage where I'm getting my car off the street. And so this has cost me thousands of, roughly maybe $3,000. Just off the bat now. Yeah. So I think that it's also a silent crisis too, because oftentimes police reports aren't made. What are you going to do? And so there's I call it the criminal tax, because this is just another tax, and you can't do anything about it. It's like this, it's like the red lights. It's just the criminal tax. Now we have
our, mutual friend Mary Schmeek lives in Old Town, and she had her Prius catalytic converter stolen. There were two Priuses on our street here in the Independence Park area, and they're both ripped off within about 30 seconds of each other one evening recently. So it is happening all over the city. As Mark says, it's like it's this crime tax. It's this feel and this feeling of helplessness. Like what are you going to do? Some in the Tribune article today, someone said that they sleep near their window so they can hear if someone's going to come out. And this woman had been victimized twice already, so she can hear when the people come and try to take it for the third time. And my argument is that's a terrible idea because these people are armed. They'll pull a gun on you. They'll shoot you. You're going to have to just accept that they may pick your car. They may take your catalytic converter, and you can be as awake as you want. You could be sitting on your front porch with a gun across your lap, and you're going to lose your catalytic converter. And that's a frightening thought for people. And again, it's the kind of thing that drives people away.
And it's happening in other cities, too. I want to insert this because I don't like sometimes that this Mincing Rascals podcast and talking about the news of the city seems to be so negative about the city of Chicago. Because
it's happening in the suburbs, too. So it's
good.
Not just a Chicago thing. Sure.
Good.
Good.
Thank God.
I'm going to get a yurt and I'm going to go live on the lake. All right. I'm out of time, guys. Any last words of wisdom from any of you smart fellas?
Get a garage if you're parking on the street.
Well, and then you got to find a place to put your garage. Evidently, you've got a little real estate there, huh? Is that what you're going to do?
There you go. Yeah.
Go Sky is what I'm saying. I'm fully on the Sky bandwagon since the baseball teams really stink and doesn't look like the Bears are going to be that good. So I'm all in for the Sky, unless they lose Wednesday night, in which case I'm off.
Let's go to the Jazz Festival this weekend. They've got it. It's a great lineup.
All right, fellas. Mark, thanks for joining us again. It's nice to have you as part of the Mincing Rascals podcast. Mark Reno and Eric Zorn. John Hansen tapped out a little while ago. We're produced by Ben Anderson and Pete Zimmerman. I'm John Williams, and we'll drop another pod on you next week.
All right. Hey, thanks, Mark. Good to see you again.
Jesus, Mark, you buried the lead. I didn't know all that. I'm sorry to hear it, man.
Yeah, it was, of course, just out of nowhere. And, I had to rent a car. And also then I had to rent a car, which, of course, the rental cars are crazy prices. And it was a week before we were going on a vacation up to North Wisconsin. So, yeah, I mean, my insurance covered the actual converter, but the rental car costs equal the cost of the converter. So,
and they didn't pay for that, huh?
No, opportunity right
yeah,
now.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. All right, fellas. Nice to talk to you. We'll be in touch.
Yeah, good talking to you. Yeah. Give Laura my best, please.
Me.
Yeah,
okay, I will.
Take care, guys.
Thanks.
Okay, thanks, John. Bye.
Subscribe to the Mincing Rascals podcast on iTunes or the Google Play Music Store. You can now also follow us on Spotify, or you can keep listening online at WGNRadio.com.